Children of Dune by Frank Herbert, continued. Cassette 6, Side 2. Alia turned to see who had challenged the preacher. The man remained hidden from her, but his voice came over the intervening heads in another shout.
If you believe him truly dead, then you are alone from this time forward.
Surely it was a priest, Alia thought, but she failed to recognize the voice.
I come only to ask a simple question, the preacher said. Is Muad'Dib's death to be followed by the moral suicide of all men? Is that the inevitable aftermath of a messiah? Then you admit him messiah, the voice from the crowd shouted. Why not, since I'm the prophet of his times? The preacher asked.
There was such calm assurance in his tone and manner that even his challenger fell silent. The crowd responded with a disturbed murmur, a low animal sound.
Yes, the preacher repeated. I am the prophet of these times.
Alia, concentrating on him, detected the subtle inflections of voice. He'd certainly controlled the crowd. Was he Bene Gesserit trained? Was this another ploy of the Missionaria Protectiva? Not Paul at all, but just another part of the endless power game?
I articulate the myth and the dream, the preacher shouted. I am the physician who delivers the child and announces that the child is born. Yet I come to you at a time of death. Does that not disturb you? It should shake your souls.
Even as she felt anger at his words, Alia understood the pointed way of his speech. With others, she found herself edging closer up the steps, crowding toward this tall man in desert garb. His young guide caught her attention. How bright-eyed and saucy the lad appeared. Would Muad'Dib employ such a cynical youth?
I mean to disturb you, the preacher shouted. It is my intention. I come here to combat the fraud and illusion of your conventional institutionalized religion. As with all such religions, your institution moves toward cowardice. It moves toward mediocrity, inertia, and self-satisfaction.
Angry murmurs began to arise in the center of the throng. Alia felt the tensions and gloatingly wondered if there might not be a riot. Could the preacher handle these tensions? If not, he could die right here.
That priest who challenged me, the preacher called, pointing into the crowd.
He knows, Alia thought.
A thrill ran through her, almost sexual in its undertones. This preacher played a dangerous game, but he played it consummately.
You, priest in your mufti, the preacher called. You are a chaplain to the self-satisfied. I come not to challenge Muad'Dib, but to challenge you. Is your religion real when it costs you nothing and carries no risk? Is your religion real when you fatten upon it? Is your religion real when you commit atrocities in its name? Whence comes your downward degeneration from the original revelation? Answer me, priest!
But the challenger remained silent, and Alia noted that the crowd once more was listening with avid submission to the preacher's every word. By attacking the priesthood, he had their sympathy. And if her spies were correct, most of the pilgrims and Fremen on Arrakis believed this man was Muad'Dib.
The son of Muad'Dib risked,
the preacher shouted, and Alia heard tears in his voice.
Muad'Dib risked! They paid their price! And what did Muad'Dib achieve? A religion which is doing away with him!
How different those words if they come from Paul himself, Alia thought. I must find out.
She moved closer up the steps, and others moved with her. She pressed through the throng until she could almost reach out and touch this mysterious prophet. She smelled the desert on him, a mixture of spice and flint. Both the preacher and his young guide were dusty, as though they'd recently come from the bled. She could see where the preacher's hands were deeply veined along the skin protruding from the wrist seals of his stillsuit. She could see that one finger of his left hand had worn a ring. The indentation remained. Paul had worn a ring on that finger, the Atreides hawk which now reposed in Siege Tabor. Leto would have worn it had he lived, or had she permitted him to ascend the throne. Again the preacher aimed his empty sockets at Alia, spoke intimately, but with a voice which carried across the throng.
Muad'Dib showed you two things, a certain future and an uncertain future. With full awareness, he confronted the ultimate uncertainty of the larger universe. He stepped off blindly from his position on this world. He showed us that men must do this always, choosing the uncertain instead of the certain.
His voice, Alia noted, took on a pleading tone at the end of the statement. Alia glanced around, slipped a hand onto the hilt of her kris-knife.
If I killed him right now, what would they do?
Again she felt a thrill rush through her.
If I killed him and revealed myself, denouncing the preacher as impostor and heretic.
But what if they proved it was Paul? Someone pushed Alia even closer to him. She felt herself enthralled by his presence even as she fought to still her anger. Was this Paul? Gods below, what could she do?
"Why has another Leto been taken from us?" the preacher demanded.
There was real pain in his voice.
"Answer me if you can. Ah, their message is clear. Abandon certainty."
He repeated it in a rolling stentorian shout.
"Abandon certainty! That's life's deepest command. That's what life's all about. We're a probe into the unknown, into the uncertain. Why can't you hear, Muad'Dib? If certainty is knowing absolutely an absolute future, then that's only death disguised. Such a future becomes now. He showed you this."
With a terrifying directness, the preacher reached out, grabbed Alia's arm. It was done without any groping or hesitation. She tried to pull away, but he held her in a painful grip, speaking directly into her face as those around them edged back in confusion.
"What did Paul Atreides tell you, woman?" he demanded.
"How does he know I'm a woman?" she asked herself.
She wanted to sink into her inner lives, ask their protection, but the world within remained frighteningly silent, mesmerized by this figure from their past.
"He told you that completion equals death," the preacher shouted. "Absolute prediction is completion, is death."
She tried to pry his fingers away. She wanted to grab her knife and slash him away from her, but dared not. She had never felt this daunted in all of her life. The preacher lifted his chin to speak over her to the crowd, shouted,
"I give you Muad'Dib's words. He said, I'm going to rub your faces in things you tried to avoid. I don't find it strange that all you want to believe is only that which comforts you. How else do humans invent the traps which betray us into mediocrity? How else do we define cowardice? That's what Muad'Dib told you."
Abruptly, he released Alia's arm, thrust her into the crowd. She would have fallen but for the press of people supporting her.
"To exist is to stand out, away from the background," the preacher said. "You aren't thinking or really existing unless you're willing to risk even your own sanity in the judgment of your existence."
Stepping down, the preacher once more took Alia's arm, no faltering or hesitation. He was gentler this time, though. Leaning close, he pitched his voice for her ears alone, said,
"Stop trying to pull me once more into the background, sister."
Then, hand on his young guide's shoulder, he stepped into the throng. Way was made for the strange pair. Hands reached out to touch the preacher, but people reached with an awesome tenderness, fearful of what they might find beneath that dusty Fremen robe. Alia stood alone in her shock as the throng moved out behind the preacher. Certainty filled her. It was Paul. No doubt remained. It was her brother. She felt what the crowd felt. She had stood in the sacred presence, and now her universe tumbled all about her. She wanted to run after him, pleading for him to save her from herself, but she could not move. While others pressed to follow the preacher and his guide, she stood intoxicated with an absolute despair, a distress so deep that she could only tremble with it, unable to command her own muscles.
"What will I do? What will I do?" she asked herself.
Now she did not even have Duncan to lean upon, nor her mother. The inner lives remained silent. There was Ganima, held securely under guard within the keep, but Alia could not bring herself to take this distress to the surviving twin.
"Everyone has turned against me. What can I do?"
The one-eyed view of our universe says you must not look far afield for problems. Such problems may never arrive. Instead, tend to the wolf within your fences. The packs ranging outside may not even exist.
The Ajar Book, Shamra 1-4. Jessica awaited Idaho at the window of her sitting room. It was a comfortable room with soft divans and old-fashioned chairs. There wasn't a suspenser in any of her rooms, and the glow globes were crystal from another age. Her window overlooked a courtyard garden one story down. She heard the servant open the door, then the sound of Idaho's footsteps on the wood floor, then on the carpet. She listened without turning, kept her gaze upon the dappled light of the courtyard's green floor. The silent, fearful warfare of her emotions must be suppressed now. She took the deep breaths of her Prana Bindu training, felt the outflow of enforced calmness. The high sun threw its searchlight along a dust beam into the courtyard, highlighting the silver wheel of a spiderweb stretched in the branches of a linden tree, which reached almost to her window. It was cool within her quarters, but outside the sealed window there was air which trembled with petrified heat. Castle Carino sat in a stagnant place which belied the greens in her courtyard. She heard Idaho stop directly behind her. Without turning, she said,
"The gift of words is the gift of deception and illusion, Duncan. Why do you wish words with me?"
"It may be that only one of us will survive," he said.
"And you wish me to make a good report of your efforts?"
She turned, saw how calmly he stood there, watching her with those gray metal eyes which held no center of focus. How blank they were.
"Duncan, is it possible that you're jealous of your place in history?"
She spoke accusingly, and remembered as she spoke that other time when she'd confronted this man. He'd been drunk then, set to spy upon her, and was torn by conflicting obligations. But that had been a pre-Gola Duncan. This was not the same man at all. This one was not divided in his actions, not torn. He proved her summation by smiling.
"History holds its own court and delivers its own judgments," he said. "I doubt that I'll be concerned when my judgment's handed down."
"Why are you here?" she asked.
"For the same reason you're here, my lady."
No outward sign betrayed the shocking power of those simple words, but she reflected at a furious pace.
"Does he really know why I'm here?"
How could he? Only Ganima knew. Then had he enough data for a Mentat computation? That was possible. And what if he said something to give her away? Would he do that if he shared her reason for being here? He must know their every movement, every word was being spied upon by Faradin or his servants.
"House Atreides has come to a bitter crossroads," she said. "Family turned against itself. You were among my duke's most loyal men, Duncan. When the Baron Harkonnen..."
"Let us not speak of Harkonnens," he said. "That was another age, and your duke is dead."
And he wondered, can't she guess that Paul revealed the Harkonnen blood in the Atreides? What a risk that had been for Paul, but it had bound Duncan Idaho even more firmly to him. The trust in the revelation had been a coin almost too great to imagine. Paul had known what the Baron's people had done to Idaho.
"House Atreides is not dead," Jessica said.
"What is House Atreides?" he asked. "Are you House Atreides? Is it Alia? Ganima? Is it the people who serve this house? I look at those people and they bear the stamp of a travail beyond words. How can they be Atreides? Your son said it rightly. Travail and persecution are the lot of all who follow me. I would break myself away from that, my lady."
"Have you really gone over to Faradin? Isn't that what you've done, my lady? Didn't you come here to convince Faradin that a marriage to Ganima would solve all of our problems?" Does he really think that, she wondered, or is he talking for the watchful spies? "House Atreides has always been essentially an idea," she said. "You know that, Duncan. We bought loyalty with loyalty."
"Service to the people," Idaho sneered. "Ah, many's the time I've heard your duke say it. He must lie uneasy in his grave, my lady."
"Do you really think us fallen that low?"
"My lady, did you not know that there are Fremen rebels? They call themselves Marquis of the Inner Desert, who curse House Atreides and even Muad'Dib."
"I heard Faradin's report," she said,
wondering where he was leading this conversation and to what point.
"More than that, my lady. More than Faradin's report. I've heard their curse myself. Here's the way of it. Burning be on you, Atreides. You shall have no souls, nor spirits, nor bodies, nor shades, nor magic, nor bones, nor hair, nor utterances, nor words. You shall have no grave, nor house, nor hole, nor tomb. You shall have no garden, nor tree, nor bush. You shall have no water, nor bread, nor light, nor fire. You shall have no children, nor family, nor heirs, nor tribe. You shall have no head, nor arms, nor legs, nor gate, nor seed. You shall have no seats on any planet. Your souls shall not be permitted to come up from the depths, and they shall never be among those permitted to live upon the earth. On no day shall you behold Shai-Hulud, but you shall be bound and fettered in the nethermost abomination, and your souls shall never enter into the glorious light, forever and ever. That's the way of the curse, my lady. Can you imagine such hatred from Fremen?